Thought I'd talk tonight about commitment to the spiritual way. Commitment. An interesting question was raised in the question and answer session we did a couple of weeks ago, which I did answer, but I did think about it later. And the question was along the lines of what we can expect from following this way. And I concluded upon reflection that it gives everyone what they truly want in the final analysis, based on perhaps an assumption, but I think from my experience it is actually the case that deep down what everyone wants is love, peace and understanding, because if we have those things then life is going to be fine. And if we perhaps consider why we come to a way like this, what it is that prompts us to inquire and perhaps come along to the centre. It's different for different people, but I'm in the honoured position of being able to talk to you all individually, and I know that there are a variety of reasons that you come. Some, perhaps the few, genuinely enter this way because they truly want to come to understand. They want enlightenment in this lifetime, if at all possible. I think for the vast majority of people, they're quite like a quiet mind. Quieter mind. Perhaps for other people, they'd love to be able to deal with levels of stress and to be able to manage the mind. Others want bliss. Of course, the blissful states that come with concentration. For others, it might be more egalitarian. Perhaps peace on earth is their aspiration and they want to find a vehicle for finding that. For others, it may be that there's a desire to belong. Perhaps they feel isolated and lonely, and there's a sense in which wanting to belong to a group of like-minded individuals and so forth. But if I was to say to you that all those reasons, a quiet mind, freedom from stress, being able to manage the mind, the bliss, peace on earth, well, much if not all of these aspirations, what the person is actually looking for is enlightenment. Good, glad we've got that sorted out. What we tend to do when we come to this way, though, we tend to come with our beliefs and our tendency to project onto the teaching what we think it's about, which is not very understandable. But when we actually come along, when the meditator first comes along, usually we find to our surprise that it isn't quite as we had anticipated or expected it to be. It's actually quite a lot different. And so initially there can be something of a sense of discord between what we perhaps have imagined it to be and how it actually is in terms of a path. And we're confronted with the Buddha's description of the world, which in many, many ways does actually put pressure on our view structure. It presents a vision of the world which is really quite different from the one that we were brought up with, the view structures that we might have developed during our life, and we're confronted with, perhaps, as an example, the suggestion that suffering, the cause of suffering, is always internal. It's our craving, our wanting life to be different. Now you think about how the world generally operates and sees life. That if there's something going wrong in one part of the world, then we've all got to get together and go into that part of the world and sort it all out on behalf of those people. There's a strong tendency to believe that we have to fix the suffering externally, whereas the Buddha is saying that's not the case. The cause of suffering is always internal. We're confronted with ideas such as true happiness cannot be found within the world, that true happiness lies beyond the world. And then we go, beyond the world? What are you talking about? What is this beyond the world? It's something that lies outside of our current view structure, our current knowledge and understanding of how the world works. So, initially, there can be a slight sense of a doubt, perhaps, or an uncertainty, or a wavering. Should I be doing this? Is this going to be good for me? What are these people talking about? The Buddha himself said of his own teaching that it goes against the stream. It goes against the stream of worldly views and of worldly aspirations. And he also said, I do not argue with the world argues with me. And what he meant by that was that, of course, the tendency when confronted with this new narrative, this new way of describing the world, set against existing view structures, can cause conflict, can cause a sense of disbelief, doubt, and a desire to argue the point and try and, in a sense, correct the Buddha. Because the Buddhist way is to practice his teaching, practice meditation, in order to gain direct experience for ourselves of the way life really is. All the Buddha is doing is offering a description of the way life is. And it's up to the individual, if they choose, if they want to find out for themselves, whether or not his description is actually accurate. On completion of the training, you find out it is as perfect a description as you can ever get of the way life really works. So that, in a sense, that's all the Buddha's doing. So he doesn't argue with the world. He just merely describes the way the world is to his, as it appears in his enlightened state, and people argue with him. There's that famous analogy that he gave, walking through the forest with his monks, of picking up a handful of leaves and asking his monks, which is greater, the number of leaves in the forest or the number of leaves in my hand? And they said, of course, the number of leaves in the forest far outweighs the number of leaves in your hand. And he said, well, just in the same way, what I know and understand is comparable to the leaves in the forest. What I teach, the way to the cessation of suffering, is comparable to the leaves held in my hand. So he only taught what was necessary in order for someone to realise that quiet mind, to realise that freedom from isolation, to realise the other things I mentioned, like freedom from stress, the bliss, and the sense of peace. So his teaching is neither deficient in what it offers, and it's not excessive either. It's just the right amount. The Noble Eightfold Path, the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. But of course, everyone has to undertake the training for themselves, if they so desire, and find out for themselves. You have to be willing to put it to the test. And this is where the commitment comes in. How do we gauge something's worth? What does it make something like iridium so sought after? If you've got a little bit of iridium in your pocket, you're in, because you can get quite a lot of money. I can't remember now, it's hundreds of thousands of pounds, you know, just for a little ounce or something of iridium. I don't know what it is, I just looked it up on the internet. It's just something very rare. And because it's rarity, that's what makes it so valuable. That's the point I'm trying to make. So how do we gauge worth? The difficulty in obtaining something is how we gauge something's worth. There is always a cost. And to obtain the fruits of this way does carry a cost. It does require commitment. Commitment, making a commitment to one thing, necessarily means having to give up options, having to give up choice. When I was thinking about this, it did make me recall a conversation I had with somebody who very briefly had asked for full-time training with a view to becoming a monk. And he came in, he was a very nice man. It transpired that he was in a relationship. And I said, well, you can't come in if you're in a relationship. We have this rule, we don't break up relationships. But he said that he and his, I think it was just a girlfriend, had agreed to split up so that he could come in and enter the monastery and hopefully ordain it as a monk. Within 2 days, he had changed his mind, and that actually what he wanted was his relationship with this particular woman. And so we had a chat, and I hope I always respect students, and I would never want to deliberately wind them up. But he was, you know, lamenting that he'd made the wrong decision, and really that he really wanted to be with this woman. So I said, well, that's fine, of course. But, you know, if you do go back to this woman, then you've really got to commit to her. And I could see the expression on his face. And I didn't want to wind him up, but I said, you know, the biological clock and everything, at some point, she's probably going to want children. And if you're committing to her, then you're committing to that, because that's a biological need in a woman. If you're in a relationship, then really, I mean, I was sort of twisting it. And he almost completely collapsed at that idea. The point being, though, that I wanted to get across that you have to commit to something. You can't keep all your options open all the time. The point being, of course, that if you are interested in, if you're desirous of Buddhist training in order to learn how to quieten your mind, in order to learn how to realize these blissful, happy, peaceful states and gain wisdom and understanding, then it does require a commitment. I divide commitment into two types of commitment, external and internal. That seems quite easy. By external commitment, I mean things like the following. For instance, when you do your introductory period, there's a commitment to doing 6 weeks. Coming on a Wednesday, keeping the precepts, and meditating every day, and not mixing it up with other spiritual practices, so putting other spiritual practices to one side, and concentrating entirely for that 6 weeks on undertaking the Buddha's way, in order to find out what happens. In order so that during that 6 weeks, somebody gets a really clear indication of the level of commitment that's required in order to make a success of the practice. The way Alan and Jackie set this centre up, I have to say, was neither excessive nor deficient in what it offers. It provides what it provides because those are all the necessary supporting conditions that help someone make a proper success of their practice. Even down to things like sitting on chairs to meditate, not having much in the way of ritual. It was all designed around Western culture, Western minds, the way Westerners tend to approach meditation in a spiritual way. So if somebody comes through that 6 weeks, they're encouraged to reflect on that 6 weeks and ask themselves, is this something I want to continue with? But with a recognition that this is the level of commitment that's required in order to make success of the practice. So it might mean that somebody has to forego something else they do on a Wednesday night. Are they willing to make that sacrifice? Willing to renounce, I don't know, hip-hop dancing on a Wednesday night so that they can attend the centre? I think you agree, it's important. It's important to have that level of commitment. And often at the end of the 6 weeks, I'll say to somebody, all right, we'll do this for 3 months then. Give yourself 3 months, you can really sort out whether something is what you're looking for by doing it consistently for 3 months. But the idea is that you do it consistently for 3 months, accepting the requirements and doing it to the best of your ability. So that's continuing to meditate every day, continuing to keep the precepts, continuing to come regularly on a Wednesday. And it really does require meditation every day. Now, these are all the external, what I call external commitments. Meditating every day, keeping precepts, attending the centre every week, retreats. Essential. It's not an optional add-on. We suggest that someone in the first 6 months should try to get a weekend retreat under the belt, and within the first year to get a full week's retreat under their belt. It's not excessive. That's a basic requirement in order to make a success of the practice. The reason being that a weekend is very good. It does help to, for a new person, it shows us where to pick up the food, what the schedule is, gives us a good indication of what really is required in terms of commitment when you come on a residential course. But really, we're kicking you out of the door before you've really had time to properly settle. It's most meditators' experience that on a week's retreat, it isn't until Wednesday that you've really got free of whatever was nagging you from the prior week at work or whatever it might be. It takes 2 or 3 days to work out what it is you're doing wrong with the meditation and correct it so that you get calm and you get peaceful. It takes that long. In fitness training, they have this idea of... I won't tell you why it is that I know so much about fitness training all of a sudden. They have this idea that you keep doing an hour or so's fitness. You have your general level of cardio or what have you, and then you have these intensive short periods where you really go for it, like 3 minutes of intensive workout, and then you go back to a slightly more gentle, regular period, and then you have another intensive 3 minutes, and then you come back, and then you have another intensive period, and that's a very important part of getting fit. That's the most efficient way of getting fit. If you can see the analogy with retreats, if someone is practicing meditation every day, they're trying to be mindful in their life generally, then those retreats are critical to get that intensive period, intensive practice. It's that makes all the difference. And I've used this quote often, but Jackie James is on record as saying that, in her opinion, a week on retreat was equivalent to a year's worth of practice at home. It is so important. So all those are what I call external commitments. But there are also internal commitments. This is a lot more subtle. Of course, commitment itself is a mental quality. What do I mean by internal commitment? It is possible to, as it were, go through the motions with meditation. It is possible to put the hours in without really putting much into the hours. And so internal commitment is the willingness to undertake the practice to the very best of our ability. This is how we get the results. For instance, we don't have too much in the way of ritual here because of the tendency for people to undertake the ritual for the ritual's sake, not understanding perhaps what the ritual is trying to put across. For instance, Three Refuges, which is a traditional chant that Buddhists do, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. But what does it actually mean? And it's so easy just to do the chant, thinking that somehow this is taking me towards peace, happiness, fulfillment and the like, when in actual fact it really isn't doing anything above and beyond trying to remind you of the importance of taking proper refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, which is effectively meditation. Internal commitment does require a willingness when practicing mindfulness to acknowledge our dark side, the Darth Vader in us all, which requires an inner honesty. Because unless you do, you can't actually come to see that these states are transient. If you can't see that things are transient, how can you let go of attachments? And the Buddha maintained that clinging attachment, born of ignorance, the true nature of life, was what causes our noisy minds. To be free of suffering, to be free of neurotic, noisy mind, you have to be free of attachments. And if you're not looking at transients, how can you free yourself from clinging to things? So that's really what I mean by internal commitment. It's that commitment to return to the meditation cushion or seat again and again and again. It's that willingness to come up against that obstacle again and again and again, always with a view to learning how to overcome it, how to get free of it, in order to experience the peace and tranquility and the freedom of that particular obstacle. It can't be done any other way. And so that is a real commitment. So it is, in a sense, that inner commitment is the choice between a normal habitual mode of behaviour in a meditation, say, perhaps hindrances, and choosing to restrain the mind and refrain from entering into those habitual tendencies, to be committed in that way, really to be awake and alive to the meditation, not just doing it by rote. And of course, included in that is one's relationship with the teacher and being open and honest and being willing to enter into what's really going on with the teacher. Again, that is a commitment. You're giving up something, aren't you, through deciding to act in that way. I was talking to somebody this week who's has terminal cancer, a long-standing meditator here, and she's the sort of person that doesn't like punches being pulled. She said, "What do I have to bear in mind?" And I said, "You have to bear in mind the fact that you're going to die. What's most important?" The reflection of death in Buddhism is not a morbid or paranoid or even self-concerned pursuit. It's recognizing reality, truly. I don't know how long I'm going to be here. Do you know how long you're going to be here? Do we know how long the center's going to be here? Do we know how long the Buddha's teaching will be available to us? Life is intrinsically transient, unsatisfactory, uncertain, insecure. It's also perfect. The realization of that comes after realizing that truly things are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not to be clung to. I reminded this lady that death was on her shoulder and that it was just waiting for the opportune moment to take her away. So what was the most important thing for her? And what's the most important thing for anyone? It's amazing how it clarifies the mind. If you know you've only got an hour to live, will you be concerned as to whether to get your hairstyle changed? It's unlikely, isn't it? Yes, it's a serious matter. But the beautiful thing about Buddhism is, of course, things do pass away, but things arise. It's the nature of existence. Things go, but they come too. So rebirth is very much a cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching. And some people can fall into the trap of thinking, well, that's fine, then I'll commit to it next lifetime. But of course, what happens next lifetime? The habitual tendency to say, I'll commit to it next lifetime, comes up just as strongly. We are creatures of habit, after all. And can we be certain when we will come across an opportunity such as this again? It's undoubtedly the case that if someone behaves in a positive way towards a teaching such as this, that they will get future opportunities to follow the way. That's the nature of karma. But when? How can we be sure, how can we be certain that it will be next lifetime? So it's something to bear in mind. It's something to bear in mind about what's most important in someone's life. What somebody is prepared to give up in order to pursue a certain line, a certain avenue. And if it is that truly that someone wants to find lasting respite from the suffering inherent in life due to the fact that you can't rely on anything for any lasting happiness, then it would seem appropriate to commit to a way such as this. The beautiful thing about Buddhism is it doesn't tell you what to do. As the Buddha said, I don't argue with the world. The world argues with me. Meditators who have undertaken the path with real commitment, lasting commitment, have always found that it has led to a lessening in their suffering, greater understanding, greater compassion and love, and people have found that it does lead to this gloriously strange idea, concept of enlightenment itself. It sounds so strange. The beyond. How can there be a beyond of the world, of any world? And yet anyone who finds it will tell you that it's what everyone is looking for. It is that very quiet mind for which people so desire. It is the ending of isolation and loneliness. And although we can never bring peace to the whole world, you can nonetheless be at peace, entirely at peace within the world. Enlightenment is possible today, just as it was in the Buddha's day. We have the opportunity. The centre was set up by people who understood. It continues to promote the Buddha's teaching from a position of understanding. Enlightenment is rare. One point I would like to make is that I think it is rarer than, how to describe this? There is a tendency, a modern tendency, among spiritual seekers, perhaps to believe that becoming enlightened is an easy matter. You often hear it said that there is nothing you need to do to become enlightened, that you're already enlightened, and all you have to do is realise it. Oh, I don't like that. Because when somebody who genuinely has found enlightenment looks back at their life and they see the level of commitment that was required in order to come to understanding, then they conclude that these people can't really know. Of course, the Buddha said, I do not argue with the world argues with me. Everyone is entitled, of course, to promote their ideas about the way the world is. But enlightenment is rare. But it's not so rare that it's impossible. But it is rare enough to make it the most worthwhile thing anybody can aspire to. It is real. People here have found it, have discovered it, have realised it. It is ultimately what everyone is looking for. But a reality check. What are you prepared to give up in order to find that quiet mind? What are you prepared to give up in order to find true peace?